Thank you. And thank you, Tony, for pushing us to think about what we can do. I would ask Alex and Paul if you have any response to the prescription, the remediation plan that Tony has proposed, or if there's other things that you would point us to on the very practical reality of today's dilemma.
Would you like to go first, Paul?
Sure. Yep. Yeah, so any really serious attempt to revive federalism and subsidiarity has to have Congress at its heart, right? So as Tony, you just said, I don't like the odds of it right now, but nevertheless, they're an indispensable player here, right? So in the Trump administration, the president, all the way, you know, cabinet secretaries, White House officials, and really all the political appointees understood that one main goal of the administration was to decrease regulation and to shrink the size of the administrative state. And that included, as one component, not the only component, but as one component, sending more power back to states, local governments, and civil society. And we made a lot of progress on that goal. It also became clear that as long as we are administering the statutes that we are administering, that we couldn't go far enough. And that's for a few reasons. One is that some congressional statutes don't just give agencies, it's doing it again. Hello? Last time there was a word that I said that stopped it. There we go. All right, so, so that's for a couple of reasons. One is that some statutes actually command agencies to regulate things that local governments and states could do for themselves. That's obviously very common. I think one example, the Fair Labor Standards Act applies workplace standards in every business with, I think, over $500,000 in annual revenues. Right, so that's every business but the most small businesses. So obviously a lot of the businesses are engaged in nothing that any sane person would recognize as interstate commerce. And the agency can't just say, we're gonna raise the threshold to 10 million. It's not allowed to do that by law. So, there are a number of statutes that actually require activity that violates principles of subsidiarity and federalism. The other reason that Congress has to be part of the solution, the biggest part of the solution, in my judgment, is that presidents, even when they're very motivated by their voters to shrink the size of bureaucracy, also like using bureaucracy. It's a way they exercise power, right? And so, I think if you'd ask the founders, do you think that a branch of government will voluntarily give up a lot of its power? They wouldn't have said no, because they would be busy laughing at you for thinking that, right? So, sometimes some presidents will pull back on executive power a little bit, but I think it's not a viable option to expect the most serious change to come from the executive. And I do think you have to have the federal government as the driver of the solution. I think, certainly state remedies of the sort that Tony describes can be incredibly impactful. But at the end of the day, the Supremacy Clause means that when the federal government takes regulatory action, it usually gets to uphold that action.
Paul, do you have any comment specifically on a local sheriff or another one of the 500,000 plus elected officials reserving to themselves the right to not comply?
Well, so they've all sworn oaths to uphold the Constitution. So, if there's constitutional action that's a directive or other sort of action that's been taken by the federal government that falls within the constitutional powers of the government, then they have to follow it if they're going to keep their oaths, and they should keep their oaths. What they should do if the action is unlawful, and they've determined after consulting with counsel that it's unlawful, certainly they should try to litigate first before just not complying.
Thank you. Alex?
I don't think that I have any advice anywhere near as good as my distinguished co-panelists. One of the benefits of being a professor is that I'm relieved of the burdens of practicality. I really think that it needs to be a decisive issue. There needs to be political organizational capital devoted to ensuring that no state official who is complicit in taking federal money for any reason gets elected or reelected. If you're willing to outsource the financing of your government, you are willing to be ruled by someone else. It is that simple. There's a reason they call it the power of the purse. I would agree with what Paul also said about Congress. One of the things that's a little bit difficult to square with is that part of the reason the executive branch and the presidency in particular is so powerful and unconstrained now is that during the Reagan Revolution, conservatives wanted to unleash the presidency because Tip O'Neill's Congress was not complying. And this was perceived as a way of actually achieving durable, concrete policy goals. So that might have made sense according to the best political prudential wisdom of the time, but now the chickens have come home to roost. We've paid attention too long to what is decided, concrete policies, at the expense of who decides. And of course, it's only the latter that is a properly basic constitutional consideration. It's been said that the American public is sleepily indifferent to these procedural matters. I hope that that's not true, because not being sleepily indifferent is the only way we solve the problem. There is no other way.
Tony, I'm going to go to Slido here modify the question slightly. In light of what Paul has said about oath keeping, is there an opening that your particular tactic that you've urged today might open up for leftists to invoke the common good, say, or any other general notion, and start a similar revolution in non-compliance?
Sure. First, I want to specify, I'm advocating non-compliance with what is not the law, according to both the Supreme Court and OMB's, believe it or not, they have guidance on guidance. They're very clear that guidance is not law, which is why it's so hard to litigate, unless they make the unforced error, which oddly you see in the Biden administration, I think because they're such zealots, often they're issuing guidance and the language is so directive you can litigate preemptively and say this actually has to go through APA. But otherwise, they do the shuffle and say, well, it's not the law, so you can't sue me. Well, if it's not the law, I'm not violating an oath to choose not to listen to it. But then they try to punish you, right, with the funds or some other way they try to get you, and that, well, then we do have potentially cause of action. So in my view, they're revealing a weakness. Our side has gotten pretty good at using APA, which is Administrative Procedures Act, using that process to really bog down agencies when they try to formally regulate, to litigate, especially industry and anybody with deep pockets. We make it hard. It's not impossible, but it would make it harder. And then if you've got a great Supreme Court and federal courts, it looks pretty good for our side, comparatively speaking, compared to a few decades ago. So you see agencies go into guidance instead. To me, that signals a weakness. And so, all right, let's attack them there. But then, you know, we're making strategy, not Gauss plans. So we know our enemy will change over time, and we adjust.
Thank you. Let's go to the microphone, and please put your question in the form of a question.
I will, thank you. I think Alexander may have partially answered my question. It relates to the way we're framing the federal government as all bad and the states as all good. Is that reasonable? As far as I can tell, the federal government is bribing the states to develop entitlement programs that fall outside the mandate of the federal government by using federal spending power. And so we can get angry at the federal government for using federal spending power, but don't the states also have some responsibility in being able to buy votes at 50 cents on the dollar or less by taking that federal spending power? So there is a constitutional issue, but isn't there also an issue of maybe a failure of democracy or the voters not holding the state's elected officials accountable? Can you comment on that? Is it all the problem of the federal government, or is it also the problem of state elected officials wanting to maintain power by taking essentially bribes that the federal government has no business bribing them with in the first place?
It is absolutely also the fault of state and local officials. This is something that it takes two to tango. The federal government can offer all the money that it wants, aside from things that are currently required in terms of statutes. As you noted, it's often profitable to take the money because it allows you to pursue political initiatives and distribute benefits to interest groups without doing all the inconvenient things that would be necessary to get that revenue otherwise. In some sense, we're swimming against the current because the political logic pushing for this is so strong. But if we're not willing to be a little foolishly romantic, what are we doing here?
Can I add just a caveat of it? Because I think it's important, the question of money. I think a mistake our side has made in the past is we've tried to aggressively go straight to convincing state legislators refusing the federal money. Believe it or not, some of them are considering it, but I think an interim step, and this gets to the report card, David, we have to get in the weeds on things like the rules that govern receipt of federal funds in our states. I can't tell you how many so-called red states with Republican supermajorities or close to it, Republican governors, allow unelected state bureaucrats to sign off on wide tranches of federal money and all the fine print, and they don't even scrutinize it. And so we could fix that next session if you wanted to. And so you can start to attack some of the strings. And if you have enough states pushing back on the strings, there's leverage there to maybe make the money a little less useful to federal ends.
Michael and Diana will come to you in just a second. We're going to go to Slido. Sean Hadley asks this. Do any of you have opinions on which federal agency poses the greatest threat to subsidiarity and the common good? And why is it the Federal Department of Education?
I defer to Paul.
That's a good contender. But with a prize like that, why can't we share it around? Right. Certainly, education operating in large part through guidance is a main offender. HHS certainly as well, operating through Medicare and Medicaid funding mechanisms is a big one. Labor as well. It comes down to what issues you're most concerned about, right? So we encounter agencies in so many different places in our daily lives, right? The agency that reminds us all that the federal government is with us no matter what we do during our working day is the Labor Department. So you might think if people spend a lot of time working as they do, then maybe we're most upset about all the things we have to do because the Labor Department tells us we have to do them. But I think if you're, obviously each of them has a fair claim to make to be the most obstreperous agency.
I think it's a good point. My only quibble would be that the person who asked the question mispronounced the name of the agency. It's properly pronounced Federal Reserve.
I dislike them all with equal fervor.
Michael.
Okay, thank you. Excellent panel. Thank you very much. I have a question for Tony and then one for the whole panel, if that's okay. Tony, when Mr. Trump was elected president, I had a friend in Alexandria, Virginia, where I live, who sold his high-tech company and was appointed by Mr. Trump the chief technology officer for the Peace Corps. And he went to his first staff meeting with all the IT people, and they all came to the conference room with their arms folded, and he tried to have a staff meeting, and they all said to him, look, we don't like the new president. We know you've been appointed to this. We are not going to talk to you or cooperate with you. And that's how it's going to be. And for 6 months, this is what he did, and then he left the government. So why can't state and local officials who are told that they have guidance or whatever have a meeting and say, yeah, we're going to get back to you, and we're working on that, et cetera. So, in other words, sort of a Martin Luther King sort of an approach, that might be interesting. And the second question for the panel is, let's say that one of you is elected president and you really do think that we have a federal overreach problem. You can't fire those 2 million people, only 6,000. Isn't that a central problem, is that we presidents come and go, but these people have lifetime sinecures?
Just a response on the first observation. I can give you an example where I think there's traction. How many of you are familiar with 4-H, the 4-H program? You teach, you know, all my kids can shoot. Well, the older ones, it's not because of me, I'm a terrible shot, it's because of 4-H. They're funded through land grant colleges, public universities, and that funding comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Last year, USDA sent out on their letterhead a letter that if a law student had written it, you'd give him an F. It was purely designed, it was prevarication. And what the letter says in a nutshell, went to all the state 4-H directors, and it said, Bostock, remember the Bostock decision? Bostock means that if you have a gentleman who has been a summer camp counselor who's now decided that he's a woman, you have to let him bunk with the 12-year-old girls in the summer camp, and oh, by the way, don't tell the parents. So these 4-H directors are often, there are people. They're fairly conservative. But if you read this letter and you don't know any better, you think you can go to federal prison. It's the law, the letter said so, right? And so I think a lot of it, Michael, is just educating state and local officials that just because some agency sent you a letter doesn't mean it's the law at all. I mean, holy cow, I did not realize how often agencies simply bluff their way through into compliance.
Yeah, so we, in the Trump administration, we issued an executive order, EO 13891, beloved by millions of Americans, read often over Thanksgiving dinner. It required, among other things, each guidance document to bear the legend, "This is not the law." So that was a step in the right direction. I remember a friend of mine whose wife is a compliance officer for a university in Florida called me and said, "Hey, the funniest thing happened the other day. My wife just discovered that this guidance isn't actually binding." I said, "Oh, that's really interesting. How did she learn that?" And of course, it had been because of the disclaimer. So I think that's really important. Michael, to your second question, what I want to say is that rule by bureaucrat is bad, and so is rule by one man, and we need to avoid both, right? So. There are some things that unaccountable bureaucrats can do that the politicals have no say over, and they do some bad things using that power. There are some things that the president can do without having to go through the anti-factionalism safeguards that Federalist 10 contemplates, and that's bad too, right? Every major regulation, basically, that the federal government does is done at the direction, or at least with the permission of the president. It's not put forward by unelected bureaucrats, right? OIRA can and does stop any major regulation except by a couple of independent agencies that the president doesn't like. And the Domestic Policy Council and the National Economic Council actually originate regulatory actions for the agency at the president's behest. So if you think of something like student loan forgiveness, that's not just the education secretary waking up with a brilliant idea in the morning, right? He did that because the president told him to do it. That's how it is with every major regulatory initiative. The part of the gravity of our predicament is that we have to shrink the power of bureaucrats while not aggrandizing the power of the third most powerful man in the universe, the other two being Xi Jinping and Thanos.
Yeah, just if you don't mind, just a Heritage Foundation after note, because I did work on a mandate for leadership uptake for Mr. Trump. We only have three people at the IRS that are confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Lois Lerner and all the rest of the heads of those agencies were not. Maybe one of the things we could do is have many more people in these agencies before the Senate to account for their behavior rather than simply say, well, we don't want one man to be a ruler of all things. Thank you.
Diana.
A couple of personal things, if I may. Michael talked about Peace Corps. I chaired the board over Peace Corps as a presidential appointee. Went to the White House, our Reagan, our appointments, over and over the unjust system that was being done. Parents, families, and friends that would find me and give their what was happening to their young people. We fought it and fought it and fought it, and we were able to do absolutely nothing. at that level as a Pride House appointee. Peace Corps is a subject that I broke my neck on, and we didn't change it. I'm a Texan, and my husband ranched, and your presentation on land is so in my heart. We ranched an old magnificent ranch on the coast of Texas down in Calhoun County, down from Port Lavaca area, and the government took it literally from my husband and his father because the whooping cranes landed on it. And they paid us a dime an acre or something ridiculous, but they took it from the top down. So over the years, we had an agreement theoretically with the government that we could lease it back for cattle. Well, that didn't, you know, that didn't last long, because in coastal land, you've got to maintain your growth. They wouldn't let us burn, they wouldn't let us mow, they wouldn't let us clear the thickets, nothing. And so it became totally uninhabitable for not only cattle, but the whooping cranes stayed, but the rest of the wildlife went. And down the road, 35 miles from there, we owned the Powderhorn Ranch. And the Powderhorn you can still pull up on the internet today, but it's now in the wildlife group out of Texas. But it too was coastal, and we got to the point with the government regulations that we really couldn't ranch that beautiful ranch under the terms we were given. So stay at it and keep talking. Thank you.
Thank you. Any responses from the panel?
Oh, just what's happening in the West, I'm surprised there hasn't been more violence. And it is just, I don't know what's going to happen there, but it is fascinating to see these people and control these agencies that have this vision of Eden in which there is no man, right? Other than them. They get to still play around in all the land they're stealing and so on, but it is just, it's outrageous and it's underreported.
We'll go back to the microphone in just a second. This question comes in from Slido. Jack Painter asks, Paul, if flourishing is our moral purpose and requires self-direction, are rights that protect the possibility of self-direction a moral imperative? And I'll open it up to others who wish to comment.
Rights do safeguard the possibility of flourishing. So respecting other people's rights is a moral imperative. I think that's the force of the question. So yes, I agree with that.
Sir.
Oh, Joe Barnett from the Heartland Institute. Excuse me. One of the things that happens at, it seems to me, at the local level, where you have tens and hundreds of thousands of people appointed to local boards and committees, which I've served on some of them, and observed them at the municipal level, is that they create, you know, the bureaucrats locally, let's say they put together a committee and a citizens committee, and it's to decide what we can do to make life better in our town, and they invite them, you know, through regulation, through spending, to, at the local level, have their preferred vision of their community and impose that on their neighbors. I've seen that, for example, aesthetic ordinances. I don't like the color you painted your house, so I'm going to do something about it through this committee. Or, I like opera, therefore nobody says this, but they say, I like football, so let's build a stadium. And I'm from Arlington, Texas, where we have three taxpayer-funded stadii. And a Medal of Honor museum, which is basically built on top of the previous city failure. So it's kind of corrupting when you ask ordinary people, you know, and it sounds good, like, how should we spend our money? what are the needs of our community or whatever, and you're inviting them to become nannies, to participate in the nanny state, to participate in the NIMBY movement, or so that's corrupting, and it flows from the fact, I think, that we don't first ask what's the function of this level of government, and how does X, Y, or Z that you propose doing, you know, is that within the boundaries of that function of government? And so we kind of invite people to participate in this, and what do you think? I mean, when given a chance, voters almost inevitably, with a few exceptions, they'll vote for the football stadium, or they'll vote for even mass transit, which, you know, and trains and all that stuff. So,
Thank you for the question.
There's no question that local government has its own pathologies. Absolutely. Look at governance at any level and something somewhere is going to go wrong. My immediate question is, what are the remedies? When the national bureaucracy becomes captured and insulated, there's not much of a remedy to be had either way. If my city council decides that it wants to make the world a better place using my tax dollars, that's comparatively easy for me to avoid. Of course, there are costs of relocation. Of course, there are costs of not being rooted. I'm not saying that those are trivial. But we should, I think, emphasize the trial and error process associated with people sorting into jurisdictions that offers them the mix of public outputs that they want at the tax prices that they're willing to pay. And I think that there also is a role for the federal government, by the way, in also ensuring that even local jurisdictions do not infringe upon basic human rights. I think that that's a valid constitutional settlement. But beyond that, I'm willing to let citizens of local jurisdictions mess things up in their own way. I'm willing to bite that bullet.
Thank goodness for San Francisco. Right, such a wonderful example for the rest of us.
Yes, sir.
This is a question on subsidiarity and as a concept. For a long time, I was a three-cheer guy for subsidiarity. But as I thought about it, it still seems a top-down structure. So it's especially bad if the top-down of the top decides to do everything. It's better if the top decides to delegate down to what it thinks is the lowest level. But it seems there ought to be something that pushes in the other direction. The best I could come up with is common law, which is bottom-up practices that pushes against top-down delegation. I'd be interested in your reaction.
Yeah, you know, it's a great point. So there's a phenomenal article by Russ Hittinger, who some of you may read, from 2008, that points out the difference between subsidiarity and decentralization. So decentralization often renders smaller groups and states, et cetera, branch offices of the central authority. And so it's like the, you know, Walmart might give autonomy to regional managers because they're more efficient that way, but it doesn't mean that Walmart is a subsidiary in organization, of course, right? So the key distinction is that the subsidiary organizations actually are, they stand on their own. They're actually not operating under a kind of derived authority from above. They're operating on the authority of the people who have come together to form them. The only role of the central authority should be not interfering with them and then ensuring that there are conditions that allow them to form and do things on their own. I totally agree with that. And by the way, I think, so you see in the reason the Constitution's protections for subsidiarity are so powerful, or were so powerful when the Constitution was created, was precisely that it didn't give the federal government authority to decide how it was going to respect subsidiarity. it made a pre-commitment in favor of subsidiarity in advance, right? The problem that you run into, so the EU, the Maastricht Treaty, actually has subsidiarity, like a subsidiary requirement. It requires the EU legislature to act only when lower organizations can't handle things. So, of course, the legislature just concludes that they can't handle things anytime the legislature would like to intervene, right? So you have to make a pre-commitment. You have to decide ex ante when the central authority will be able to intervene, or else the merits and the subsidiarity inquiry collapse.
We'll go to the microphone next. I want to follow up on that because I think it might loop back to one of the previous questions. In the state of Utah, which is one of those that was thinking about refusing the largesse coming from No Child Left Behind, I had a chance to meet with some of the legislators, and they related that in that particular battle, what happened is that representatives from the Department of Education in the Bush administration visited with them and said that if you dissent and lead the charge to refuse the dollars, we will run advertisements saying, how would you explain this to a single mother of two or three kids, the fact that you're leaving money on the table? I wonder if each of you might comment, if you care to, on the pressure that can be brought to bear, contravening that kind of pressure for state legislators. How is it that they would be able to decline, because in many cases, Tony, you pointed us to the year 2046, at which time the states are going to be receiving the majority of their budgets, right? The majority of states, the majority of their budgets from the federal fisc. How do we work with state legislators to show them and their constituents that there is virtue in these commitments to subsidiarity?
Well, so I think first I would not lead with cut off the federal money because I don't think it won't sell. But I think there are things you can do, first of all, there's a lot of intentional and tacit collusion that goes on between state officials and federal officials. And you can impose your legislature more readily between those bodies. And once you begin to sort of surface the strings, you have more opportunity to intervene because sometimes you get the state pushed around just because nobody's trying to push back. Mm-hmm. So that is where we want to first apply pressure on legislatures is give yourselves the authority that you already should have and start using it to understand the dollars coming in and at least ask harder questions. And then if you get enough states that are banding together and saying, we don't like this rule or that rule, you can start to exert pressure. There, it's not unprecedented that agencies will change their tune a little bit at least. If there's pushback. So I think you start there, and then you've got to get your congressional delegations to move, I would say, more towards a block grant approach versus the current approach. But I wouldn't lead with, let's just cut off the federal dollars. And if you want to do that, then, I won't go further, but that's my thought.
We have time for two more questions, please.
Thank you all so much. This panel was really valuable insights and really exciting to listen to. I taught high school for a number of years, and one essay that I like to read with students was Woodrow Wilson's The Study of Administration, and the way that he draws that distinction between elected officials and unelected bureaucrats, and just seemed to be so intellectually disingenuous to say that the Founding Fathers weren't worried about the tyranny of administration, the tyranny of unelected bureaucrats. Could you address how the Founders, maybe in the Federalist Papers or other documents, how they address the possible growing federal government presence and so forth? Like, you know, it's like, I'm from Virginia. We've got Sixth Emperor Tyrannus and that one person that Lady Liberty is standing on. But is there an understanding of the dangers of an ever-growing bureaucracy in the minds of the Founders?
So everyone should read that essay. I think the most interesting line in the essay is that there's a paragraph where Wilson says, free and despotic governments have to have basically the same administrative apparatus. And he says, consider it this way, a slave and a free man have to use the same bodily emotions, although they pursue different ends with them, right? But of course, Aristotle says exactly the opposite of that in the Politics, that there's a way of doing things that is a free way of doing them, actually. The freedom is not a matter of just of ends, but pursuing free ends flows back into the way you pursue them, right? So I think it's remarkable to me that Wilson has this kind of, he may well have actually been responding to that line in Aristotle, right? That he's maintaining this kind of indifference as to means. That's one of the main incorrect conceits of modern politics, is that there's no natural connection between means and ends. Putting that aside, the founders were not unfamiliar with bureaucrats. There were bureaucrats in the Atlantic world in the 18th century. The founders didn't like them very much. So I think, they weren't terribly worried about bureaucracy in America. That didn't seem to, wasn't top of mind, but they certainly were worried about executive power. And there is, of course, the famous line I think, the notes on the state of Virginia, where Jefferson says, we should object as strongly to many tyrants as to one, right? I think he would say whether they're all collected in a single assembly or dispersed across innumerable agencies.
The remarkable thing about Woodrow Wilson, and that is it's great that you're teaching that essay, is that one of those pre-commitments that was so strong to natural rights, he takes as something that had to be discarded, right? So the idea of the Declaration of Independence, all men being created equal, natural rights, is the equivalent of horse and buggy and has to be abandoned. Mr. Roy, last question.
Hi, David. Thank you, and thanks to the panel. Very, very illuminating panel. I'd like to share an anecdote from healthcare land and see if you had any comments, particularly you, Tony, as the SPN guy. The Trump administration, in response to Obamacare, tried to liberalize a bunch of the rules around Medicaid and create a lot more state flexibility for Medicaid under Obamacare. The then administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Seema Verma, they went through all this trouble, created this new guides, hosted a summit with all the state Medicaid directors to brief them on all the new flexibility they were going to have and how to apply for it and how to use it. And then the number of states that actually took advantage of the flexibility was one out of 50. And I would get a call every week from Seema Verma asking, can you help us? Can you talk to some of these state Medicaid directors and explain to them what we're doing? And I did my best, but none of them wanted to do it because the state Medicaid directors or their bosses were terrified of deploying that flexibility in ways that would benefit their constituents. Because if you're that state Medicaid director, it's all downside for you. If something goes wrong, you get blamed. And if something goes right, the governor maybe gets the credit, but not you. And so in areas where Washington actually tries to give flexibility to states, a lot of times the states don't want to use it. And I'm just wondering, Tony, if you have any insights on that, if you think that's particular to healthcare or is that a generalizable concern?
No, thanks for bringing that up. And this gets to the point where I think you don't have to lead with, hey, just don't take federal money. But there's a lot that legislators can do in the states to assert proper control over their own bureaucracies. Mm-hmm. So our Federalism Report Card, half of it is made up of those kinds of institutional markers, because a lot of these folks who are in this bureaucracy, certainly not all of them, you can't paint with a broad brush, they are amenable to the ideological goals of their federal counterparts. So that school discipline guidance that I mentioned to you, I can't tell you how many state departments of public instruction in some ways are pushing that same line about, gosh, maybe we should reconsider whether we suspend violent kids. Well, they're taking their marching orders, right, from their counterparts in D.C. And so this is another example where legislators, now not talking about Congress, but state legislators, have to do their doggone jobs. Because they're not just there to pass laws. They're there to exercise proper oversight and investigate. Every committee should be an oversight committee, in my opinion, but you've got some red states that don't even have an oversight committee. So there's some things that they could do, I think, that would be that interim step, because it's not always an overt threat where the federal government says, do what we want or we'll take the money. Quite often there's issuing all this matter, And then the recipients, state officials on the other end, are receiving it gladly and happily implementing it. And then if you ask a question, if you're one of those legislators and ask a question, what you're likely going to hear is, well, it's the law, which usually isn't even true. So I think just more curious legislators who believe in legislative supremacy would be a great first step before we start talking about just cutting off the money.
Thank you so much for a great panel. Let's thank our panelists, please. Now to wrap us up, Bridget Wagner.
Thanks very much. Thank you all so much. I want to thank first our speakers and our chairs for your participation. You all did a fabulous day job today, so I want to give you all a round of applause. I think it was a great kickoff last night with Glenn Lowry and this morning's panel and discussion of the revolutionary nature of the left. I thought was a really good kind of wake-up call and a good reminder. The panels that followed, the discussions of the role of the entrepreneurs, the courts, the need to renew our social institutions, and then this closing panel with a very practical discussion of reform and federalism, I thought were just great. Thank you to all the attendees for joining us, and a special thanks to the staff, Lenore and Carissa, for helping to organize and execute this meeting. The Society keeps a very lean operation and a voluntary board, so we're a small and merry band. Thank you all to the board members and everybody who had input in putting together this program. I want to also encourage the guests who are interested in joining the Society as a member to follow up with your sponsor. And we would love to see you return, and particularly to return to our 60th anniversary meeting, which will be next April 19th through 21st at the Grand Hyatt Tampa Bay in Tampa, Florida. We have a very special program in the works. We've also lined up the Harry James Orchestra as a special treat for those who like to dance. We encourage you to invite your colleagues and spouses. I've already talked to a number of people who have a list of colleagues that they would like to invite, and several who mentioned that they're bringing their spouses. And if you would like to sponsor this special meeting in April, our 60th anniversary Diamond Jubilee, we have a number of special activities that you can sponsor and special recognitions available. We have a sheet that lists them very helpfully. Feel free to come up to Lenore or to me during the reception, or certainly follow up with us as you return home over email. We invite you to socialize further during the short reception in the foyer. We do have a cash bar, but we hope you enjoy the fellowship and company before you head off to dinner. And we wish you all safe travels and look forward to seeing you next April in Tampa. Thanks so much.